From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And in the first part of the show, we're going to be talking about the advanced technologies being used in the recycling industry. We'll speak with Recycle Utah's Jim Bedell and Troy Holding, along with Senior Manager at AMP, Sarah Doshback, about the improving sorting capabilities of single-stream recyclables using advanced technologies, including artificial intelligence.
That's right. Then in the second part of the show, we'll speak with author Catherine Palmer Gordon about her new book, This Place Is Who We Are, Stories of Indigenous Leadership, Resilience, and Connection to Homelands. The book profiles Indigenous communities in central and northern coastal British Columbia that are reconnecting to their lands and waters. Indigenous peoples and cultures are integrally connected to the land. Well-being in every sense, physical, social, environmental, economic, spiritual, and cultural, depends on that relationship, which is based on a fundamental concept. When the land is well, so are the people. That's in the second part of the show. Environmental awareness and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
How about we go around the horn and have you introduce yourself and what your role is, respectively, where you are. And Sarah, I'm actually going to start with you.
Thank you so much, Claire. Really happy to be here. Thank you for hosting me. So I have been at AMP for just about 2 years now. I am on the commercial origination team, so focused on selling AMP products. And what I mean by that is AMP designs, builds, and operates AI-powered recycling facilities that can sort single-stream recycling as well as municipal solid waste, really recovering a lot of the valuables that would otherwise be going to landfill.
Wow. Fantastic. And Jim?
Well, I'm Jim Bedell, the general manager of Recycle Utah. And I want to just thank Sarah for being here today, and also Chris, you and Claire for hosting us for the show, because there's some pretty exciting things going on in the industry, and we're going to get a chance to hear about them from people who know what they're talking about.
Great. And tell us your role at Recycle Utah.
Well, as the general manager, I'm responsible for overseeing the entire operation and a large portion of what I've been focusing on for the last year or so, following in Chris's footsteps from his time at Recycle Utah, is
on
trying
the board.
To on
I
the
was
board.
The board member.
That's
you,
true.
You have a lot more on your plate.
Yes, yeah.
But you did lay the groundwork. You and many people before you for helping us think as a community what we really truly need in terms of landfill diversion systems.
It takes a village.
It does take a village. So,
and I am proud of how our community shows up in recycling and that it is so important to our community members. And Troy, tell us a little bit about yourself and what role you play at Recycle Utah.
Yes, so I'm Troy Holding. I've been with Recycle Utah now for about 9 years. I'm the director of operations, so if you're there doing your recycling, you've probably seen me.
Telling you to move your car?
Yeah, something like that. Preventing accidents.
Which is traffic control, the whole deal.
A constant challenge.
Yeah, it must be done.
In that lot, okay. But today we're going to focus on, as you alluded to, Jim and Sarah, the technologies and the advancement of technologies to sort recyclables, mixed waste, single stream recyclables. And so I thought maybe we would start to get have our listeners understand what sorting is. And there's several different ways that we sort recyclables. So I guess the one way is that the individual, the homeowner or business owner, can sort their recyclables at their home or at their business. So that is what you see a lot at, Troy and Jim, at Recycle Utah, correct?
Correct, yes.
So people are showing up with their plastics in one container and their cardboard in another and their styrofoam in a third. So they, in effect, do the sorting. Do you do any sorting at Recycle Utah after that?
Nothing other than just quality control. The expectation is that people will bring in their material, sort it themselves, and then on the back end when we are going through the baling process, obviously we want our product that we're sending out to be the best that it can be, and so we will sort if we're seeing contamination, but that's about it.
And is that contamination that you might see in the paper stream or in the plastic stream? Or where most likely do you see it?
Across the board. I mean, okay. It can be someone bringing in their TV box and they just forgot to take the styrofoam out or whatever it may be. And so we'll remove the styrofoam and, you know, process that okay. as well separately.
Okay. So that's an example primarily of what goes on at Recycle Utah. The sorting is done prior, you know, let's say 90% of it is done prior to an individual showing up at the place. They do the yeoman's work of sorting, and good job on them. They do a pretty good job.
That's what right? we hope for, yes.
Okay. Jim, do you agree?
No, absolutely. Okay. And from a business model point of view, it's actually kind of nice because the labor that is required to sort stuff is not something that we have to pay for at Recycle Utah. It's basically, right. you know, a situation where the users will apply their own time and effort to sort materials.
And of course, the critical thing here is that the better the sorting, the higher the quality, Troy, you alluded to, higher the quality of the material, and the potentially the more valuable it is.
Correct.
As you sell it, you know, clean cardboard and clean paper and clean plus or minus plastic, et cetera. Okay, so that's one type of sorting. The second one, I'm going to guess, is the more single stream based, or it's a function of single streams. That's the sorting that occurs when we put all of our material into a can, one can, like the county's operations. You put your paper and your plastic and your aluminum can into one can, and then you wheel that out to the curb, and then a truck appears, takes it away. Where does that material go in this area, and what happens to it?
Currently, we have two MRFs, which are material recovery facilities down in Salt Lake, and it's sent down there where they will sort it the best of their abilities and then prepare it for market and get it sent out.
So the sorting that goes on there, is it by hand? Is it by, are there machines involved? Give our listeners a sense of what that looks like.
Yeah, it's a combination of machines and by hand. The technology is evolving all the time, and so if you would have gone down there 5 to 10 years ago, it was just a conveyor belt with a bunch of individuals standing yeah. there with, you know, their designated material that they were supposed to pull off. It was very slow, and a lot of material went through, and so that's where a lot of it was ending up in the landfill potentially. Where now, with companies like AMP, we're seeing technologies are catching up to the volumes that are needed to be processed.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I visited one of the MRFs about 10 years ago now, and you're right, Troy, the majority of the sorting was done by hand. Mm-hmm. People, it was stunning, that's the best word I can describe, that they would stand there along a conveyor belt and they would be tasked with, this person would be tasked with just pulling plastic film bags out of the line. Another person was tasked with pulling garbage, apple cores and orange rinds and stuff. That happened to be in there. So it was a lot of physical labor. It was really bad conditions, smells, dust, rats. You know, I mean, it was not a pleasant place to be.
What a picture you are painting.
Well, it's not a pleasant place to be. And I want to make sure our listeners understand that, because technology has come a long way to help reduce the human involvement in that for health and safety reasons, and also produce a better quality material at the end. So now, we're slowly getting to you, Sarah. We haven't forgotten. Now,
well, can we put a pause on that? Because I am curious about, first of all, talking about how the systems work together in Utah, in our communities, what that looks like, and how close related you are to making sure that there are these streamlined services and who you're working with. Because it sounds like there's a lot of partnerships, and partnerships are very important for you all.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the nice thing about recycling is there's not a lot of necessarily competition. We're all on the same team. Mm-hmm. And that's what we've found when we go out and reach out to these companies that we work with, whether it is the MRFs down in Salt Lake that are doing the sorting, or it's the companies like Momentum who are actually taking the glass and processing it and doing the recycling themselves. Hopefully that.
Yeah, and I think that that's really important, is to work together as a team, because like you said, we're all in this together. These mm-hmm. are our streams. These are our landscapes. And if we don't work together, then we could be a little bit, in more peril than coming together with different entities in the state. Chris.
Okay. So, that's a good point, because, like, for example, where does the cardboard go once it's put on the truck? Does it go to some facility in Salt Lake where it's turned back into new cardboard, or does it travel to other states or even across to other countries? Do we have a sense of where
that other material states. Is? So the paper mills are either in the Pacific Northwest.
Okay.
There's one, I believe, in New Mexico, or most of ours will go by rail to the Midwest.
Oh, wow.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So it's reprocessed, and I'm assuming that most cardboard is just turned back into more cardboard, mm-hmm. fresh cardboard, let's call it.
Yes.
Okay. That teamwork like that. And so the markets are play a big role, too, in making sure that there's some value in collecting that. So now we're getting back, though, to the technologies that are starting to show up. Well, they've been around for decades, I guess. Talk a little, maybe Sarah, you can jump in here and talk about some of the kind of the older technology, original technologies that were used to help sort cans from glass and paper and plastic. I'm thinking like magnets and drums and things like that. Mm-hmm. Sarah, talk a little more about that.
You guys nailed it. The human sorters is a huge thing in recycling facilities. I know it works very well with Recycle Utah and the discipline of what everyone's doing there. But when you are sorting at scale, it's really hard to have human sorting throughout facilities. There's also a lot of other kind of bulky, expensive equipment. You mentioned a couple things, you know, like drums and magnets and large screens and things that really kind of have to pull off a lot of the material. And with that, you're also getting a situation where that specific equipment can really only process certain types of materials. You know, I think there's limitations to that. Where we come into play with the artificial intelligence is we have really dynamic equipment. So we have these modular jet units. They're basically have a camera on top and then an air-powered valve that can essentially be reconfigured to sort whatever material we want it to sort with quite literally a click of a button. So we basically are designing these facilities with these jet units throughout and cameras throughout the facility. So we can constantly monitor everything that's going through the facilities, what they're actually sorting to. So what materials we want those jet units to target. And then as materials coming through the jet unit on a conveyor line, we're able to basically target that material, sort it, and then it goes into its own bunker where the rest of that material is so that it can then be baled. What we're trying to do is remove a lot of kind of the bulkier, expensive equipment, put in these lower cost jet units that are all based on this camera-based AI that we've been building that we're constantly training to recognize billions and billions of images so that it's constantly getting smarter and smarter and see sort of, you know, this is what a deformed aluminum can looks like. This is what a crushed plastic bottle looks like. We can get down to kind of the logo level even in terms of recognition. So trying to basically take out some of those really dangerous jobs that humans are doing where people can get hurt if material is not properly separated in single stream. And essentially offer more upskilled jobs where humans are actually using the AI.
And these technologies are being developed right here with your company, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly. So we have a few facilities. We have one in Cleveland, or just outside Cleveland, Ohio. That one's sorting recyclables. We have a facility in Greenville, North Carolina. That's also sorting single stream. We have a facility in Portsmouth, Virginia, that's actually sorting municipal solid waste. So pulling recyclables out of a much dirtier stream. That's municipal solid waste is basically kind of the black bin garbage.
Yeah.
And then we have a facility coming online with Waste Connections in Denver. And that'll be sometime in 2026.
All right, I want to get into that municipal solid waste separation because that is fascinating. But first, it's radio, so we have to visualize here in as simple a way as possible. You got a conveyor belt, and on down, coming down his conveyor belt is bits of plastic, bits of glass, aluminum cans, plastics of all sorts, and maybe municipal waste, like I was describing, like apple cores or other putrescible wastes. What is the camera doing? And what do you keep just talking about these jets? What are they doing specifically?
Yeah, it's a little hard to describe. You guys can all check out the video on YouTube or on our website. But basically, that material enters the facility. We generally put it into a reducer that kind of shreds the material and sizes it down to 12 inches or less, so it becomes manageable and movable by air. Basically, that material is going down a conveyor belt. And there will be rows of jet units. So these jet units are kind of these sort of modular, big square units that material, one particular jet unit can target one different material or several different materials. But as that material is going down the conveyor belt, that jet unit, if a certain jet unit's targeting aluminum cans, for instance, it will fire on all the aluminum cans with air. And so all those aluminum cans will get shot up and then move to a different conveyor belt where they will then get sorted into a bunker in the material recovery facility.
Okay. So again, it's like the camera in milliseconds identifies that's a piece of plastic, that's an aluminum can, that's a piece of glass. And then at some point along the conveyor belt, puffs of air actually blow the can up into a like you say, eventually another belt, a conveyor belt or a bunker, and another puff of air blows a piece of plastic into its proper bunker. Is that right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So those air jets are kind of within that unit, directly under the camera. And so that, as you know, we will equip a facility with many jet units. That's really what's powering the system. So at the end of the day, we're monitoring everything. We're able to track purity. We're able to track contamination. And we've trained this AI to basically be able to identify all types of colors, textures, shapes, brands, logos, all sorts of things, so that if a customer is buying a facility through us, they can be assured that the technology is going to continue to get better. They're not going to be left with, equipment that will just degrade over time. There are, aspects of our facilities that are, we have some traditional equipment, but for the most part, they're mostly these jets.
Yeah, and what's, from our community's perspective, I want to jump back to something that Sarah said early on. The way this technology's been evolving is things are smaller. They're more compact and more affordable nowadays. So Sarah, when we first met, I guess it was 2 years ago, and when I was first introduced to this technology and Troy and I were looking at it, it was way out of our price range. Mm-hmm. I mean, the facilities you were building were largely for communities much, much larger than the Wasatch back. And so while we were intrigued by it, it wasn't really on our radar screen. But just in the last 2 years, the scale and the price and the quality has all moved in a direction that makes it more achievable for smaller communities like ours.
And we are speaking with Sarah Doshback from AMP, also Recycle Utah's Jim Bedell and Troy Holding. And in these next couple minutes, I do want to bring it to that local level, Jim, of what is happening now with Recycle Utah, what we can look forward to in the future, and how these technologies are going to change the face of how we recycle here in our own community.
Yeah, it's. I think we're at a fortunate time right now in that, we've all been talking quite a bit about the need for greater investment in our community to allow us to divert more material from the landfill. And one advantage we have, and we were talking about this, I guess, before we came on the air, is when you look at these MRF facilities that Troy was alluding to down in Salt Lake, a lot of them have been there for decades, and they've been able to implement new technologies along the way, but they're kind of handicapped, if that's a fair way to think about it, by their legacy systems. We have the opportunity here in our community to build from scratch. We all know that Recycle Utah will be moving next year. We've been engaged in great conversations about what the future looks like. And we do kind of have a clean canvas here to think about you know, can we employ this type of technology? Is it useful? The benefit of what Sarah was describing is it allows us to bring more unsorted materials. Right. To us, which is easier for visitors and also locals. You don't have to go through that wonderful time and effort that Recycle Utah users do to sort material if we have affordable and effective technology that allows us to take unsorted materials and fairly quickly sort them.
And to get back to the point that how damaging it is when we let things just go into the landfill and what is happening to our environment and our community if we don't do these things, it could be very detrimental. So to keep an organization like Recycle Utah alive and well, and also looking at what is happening in our world with AI and what AMP is doing, marrying that together could be so beneficial for everyone in our community.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, it's thousands of tons. Jim, Troy, give me the better number, but thousands of tons of material that gets recycled each year just by Recycle Utah. And that's thousands of tons of material that don't go into the landfill. Is it like over 3,000 tons?
Yeah, we're about 1,700 tons, more or less. The community, when you think about what happens commercially as well as curbside, is about 7,000 tons a year. And the goal, if we want to triple our diversion rate, is to add another 15,000 on top of that. So
yeah.
All right, because it's out there.
Yep.
We are consuming, and we are generating. Consuming highly, and if we're going to continue to do that, which that's a whole nother conversation, is our consumption, but if we're going to continue to do that, then we need to think about where everything is going and how we make sure that it is being reused and recycled.
Right, and producing, again, at the end of the day, Sarah, the product that is produced at these advanced sorting facilities is valuable. It's high quality stuff, high quality cardboard, paper, plastic, and again, the plastic gets separated by type.
Yes, we can separate just about anything. We can train our technology to really sort whatever we want. So, yeah, I think it's something that I hope Utah will consider, and we hope to scale these facilities all over the country to divert more material from these landfills that are filling up so fast.
All right, well, we have to, unfortunately, wrap up. That was fast. Sarah, again, remind people of your website, and again, remind people where some of your facilities are located around the country.
Absolutely. So our website is ampsortation.com. Yes. Our facilities are located in Cleveland, Ohio, Portsmouth, Virginia, Greenville, North Carolina, and there will be one relatively close to you all, right just outside Denver in 2026.
Oh, okay. All right.
Fantastic.
We'll go field trip.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You're all welcome.
That would be great. You know how much I love a field trip.
Of course.
It's amazing.
Recycling facility.
Excellent. So, Jim and Troy, how can people follow along as we look forward to what the future is for Recycle Utah?
Well, at this point, you know, what we've been talking about today in terms of technology is something that we will certainly consider more seriously once we decide, you know, where we're moving and what type of facility the community wants to build. But I think the interesting thing today is just to make everybody aware of how achievable it is for us as a community to get this type of technology here.
Yeah, and your website again?
Is recycleutah.org.
Perfect. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yep.
And our next guest is author Catherine Palmer Gordon, who wrote a new book called This Place Is Who We Are, Stories of Indigenous Leadership, Resilience, and Connection to Homelands. Thank you so much for joining us, Catherine.
Good morning, Claire. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I am so excited to dive into this book. It's a beautiful read and storytelling. It is a way that we connect. It is a way that we humanize, and it is a way that we have greater understanding and begin conversations. And your storytelling is quite beautiful. But I want to start first with you and your background and how you started writing about First Nations people and why this topic was so important to you.
That's a great question to start with. Thank you. I've had the incredible privilege, really, to work with Indigenous peoples, both in Canada and in Aotearoa, New Zealand, which is where you can hear the accent. I've lived in Canada for far longer than New Zealand, but the accent stays with me. The joy of working with Indigenous peoples in various roles. I've worked writing with Indigenous peoples. I've worked in intergovernmental relations work with Indigenous people in stewardship, land stewardship, and communications. And in the course of close to 30 years of doing that, I've learned so much from them about humanity, about the connection to place. You know, these are people who typically live in places where their ancestors have lived for, in some cases, as long as 14,000 years. You know, that's 700 generations. That's longer than any other civilization on Earth. And they've lived there successfully using systems of environmental stewardship, relationship to the land and water, relationship to each other, and systems of, laws, protocols, ways of behaving that are successful. I mean, they're still here. And about 15 years ago, I started working with an organization called Post Funds. It's an Indigenous-led organization that supports conservation and sustainable economic development among the First Nations of the Great Bear Rainforest in British Columbia, Canada, on the West Coast. And again, I was so fortunate to be able to be working with Indigenous peoples who've got such wisdom and brilliance and knowledge about systems of land and resource management that integrate human beings into those systems of resource management instead of siloizing us as something separate to the land and water. And in this era where we're seeing the impacts of climate change, unsustainable resource management, all of these things that are a danger and a threat to human beings, and there is this better way of doing things where we can still, you know, prosper and have access to our natural resources, but in a much better long-term way where our grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and 700 generations from now will still be thriving. So about 5 years ago, I decided it's time to write about this particular aspect of the story, building on relationships and the work I have already done over the last 20 years or so in writing with First Nations.
Yeah, I'm curious about what you just said about in this day and age, what is different in how the Indigenous people are approaching climate change and what maybe ancient practices or things that they are carrying forward that they're pulling from their experience that they have passed on from generation to generation in such a technological time. Why are they hearkening back and seeing that there might be better ways to connect to the place that they live in and how they can become closer to it and protect it better?
What I'm hearing from Indigenous peoples and the stories in this place is who we are just some of those stories of some of the great initiatives and the Indigenous leaders who are talking about this exact issue is what we haven't necessarily understood until recent decades, and certainly was a huge theme coming out of this book, and I really absorbed it when I was listening to them. Is that the systems that were in place for environmental stewardship prior to the arrival of the first European immigrants to the North American continent were really brilliant. You know, they were the end result of these millennia of trial and error, of experimentation. You know, as Spencer Greening, who's one of the voices in the book, he's a Gitgat scholar and a PhD holder, and Spencer talked about the fact that, you know, Indigenous peoples on the coast and you know, everywhere on the North American continent have experienced the kind of things that we're experiencing today. They've experienced earthquakes and volcanoes and tsunami and cycles of ice and fire. They've had to deal with war and famine and all of these things that impact the availability of food and shelter. And they've learned from it, and they've developed these laws and protocols and systems where they are based on relationships to the land and relationships to each other and protocols that say, this is how we harvest natural resources. This is how we interact with each other. If you have fish in your particular area where you've got responsibilities to take care of them, but we've got an abundance of deer or berries or whatever the other resources, trees, cedar, whatever's needed to sustain life, is we've got arrangements in place where we exchange those things, we take care of them, we'll tell you if there's not enough this summer for you to have, we'll tell you if there's an abundance of this for you to have. And so these, how resources are harvested are based on these relationship protocols, which say, rather than draw lines around a map, which is what we as non-Indigenous resource managers tend to do, we say, these trees here within these lines on the map belong to us. You know, those might be yours over there, those lines of a map. And you know, that's a system that's set up to fail. It's a system that sets off land wars. It's a system that's unsustainable. That's where we see, you know, food resources and trees and water resources completely depleted. And so in this time where we are seeing massive depletion of it, where thanks to technology, thanks to the internet, thanks to the greater awareness of what's happening around the world, we can see that people in some parts of the world are starving. We can see that trees are completely gone from certain areas. We can see that the ocean is suffering, and there's much greater amplification of these issues. Here, what on offer is a system that is age old, that is being brought forward into the 21st century, and we're hearing Indigenous peoples saying, and through the book I'm amplifying those voices, saying, isn't it time we look back at those systems of management that are so productive and sustainable? We wouldn't be here 14,000 years later if they weren't successful. We wouldn't still be here despite all of the impacts of colonization upon Indigenous peoples if these systems weren't successful and sustainable. And by the way, we've got such sophisticated technology in the 21st century. We should be applying that technology to these systems, not to the kind of, you know, mass monoculture that results in plant disease die-offs, that results in, you know, corporate monopolies over certain food supplies, and is restricting the ability to be sustainable. Let's use the technology of science to support these better ways of harvesting, protecting the environment, putting humans right into that environment as part of it rather than separating them. And on the West Coast in BC, which I know best, the Indigenous peoples are utilizing that technology, and particularly through land and water guardian programs that they've instituted, stewardship through networks of very professional, highly trained Indigenous guardians who know how to use drone technology, who know how to monitor and enter scientific data into system and analyze it in laboratories to find out what's happening on the ground in the water right now, in order to enable great decision making about how to manage those resources into the future.
So good stewards of the land, understanding what the land may or may not be able to provide, and the waters may or may not be able to provide on an annual basis, you know, like you allude to, Catherine, that, you know, due to drought or due to fire or due to other natural calamities, the yield of this the one crop of fruits or vegetables may not be as great as the previous year. So understanding that, and then, like you say, building relationships between tribes who may have an abundance of one type of resource versus another, salmon versus corn or something like that, and building relationships to trade amongst those things. One thing they didn't do that the colonists were really, really, really unfortunately good at is to harvest those resources in an overabundant way and put them on a ship and send them overseas or to another part of the country, i.e. turn natural resources into a commodity. They did not, the indigenous tribes did not look at resources as a commodity like that.
That's, you know, I don't want to speak for indigenous peoples particularly, but, you know, the comment or reflection I'd offer on that is, you're absolutely right. You know, indigenous peoples didn't commoditize natural resources in the same way as colonists. They didn't do mass harvesting.
Right.
It all off for capitalism. And that's a word you hear quite often in this conversation, is capitalism is a huge culprit in the resulting depletion of natural resources on the planet. But that is not to say that indigenous peoples, like everybody else in the world, didn't harvest fish and sell it. They did.
Mm-hmm.
They might have used different forms of currency. They might have, and actually post-colonization, they used the same currency as everybody else. Indigenous peoples on the West Coast were some of the most successful fishermen. Of course, they knew what they were doing. They just did it a different way and in a different system that made it much more sustainable in order to do that. And I just wondered, what came to mind as you were asking that question was just you know, this isn't confined, this way of thinking or understanding isn't confined to, you know, the last decade. It isn't confined to necessarily indigenous peoples. I mean, they're the progenitors of this great, brilliant system of taking care of business. But we have examples from all over the world where there's a huge amount of collaboration going on with indigenous peoples and other groups to do better. And then the United States, you know, the United States is a great example of huge leadership on the part of particularly local governments, municipalities, state governments to declare the earth or the planet or parts of the planet, river systems or mountains, as having rights for nature, same kind of rights as human beings have in order to protect them. In New Zealand years ago, I'm going to say 30 to 40 years ago, the local Māori at the bottom of the South Island, Stewart Island, came together with local non-Indigenous commercial fishermen, Indigenous commercial fishermen, recreational sports fishers, to recognise that one of the richest areas for fishing in that part of the world, Paterson Inlet, was completely depleted. And they all came together and agreed, we're just going to stop fishing in here, full moratorium on fishing in this area, and see what happens. And within 20 years, Paterson Inlet was thriving again. So these ideas in the modern context aren't necessarily new. They are being talked about more and more and more. And that's what I hope that books like this will do, is just raise and elevate that level of awareness that we all benefit if we all work together with these ideas in taking care of the way in which we harvest natural resources. That's not about stopping harvesting trees. I live in a wooden house. You know, it's not about stopping fishing. I love seafood.
Yep.
It's just about doing these things differently and in a better way so that everybody prospers and benefits.
And I think it goes to what that ultimate goal is, too, that we are setting, because it feels like the goal looking forward and understanding the importance of the impact that we are making now and thinking about what is happening in generations to come. So it's this, I guess, forward generosity of how we interact with the land now and what we are doing now and having the thought of caring for the future instead of just the here and now. And it seems in the book that idea of generational care is there.
Absolutely. It's taking that long-term view that is bigger than, for example, political cycles. Because there's no question that having governments support this kind of work is critical. And, you know, without getting political about it, we're seeing some beautiful examples around the world again, and in Canada recently, of governments collaborating again with philanthropic organizations like Moore Foundation, the United States, the Nature Conservancy, the Land Conservancy, and working together with Indigenous groups like Coast Funds, who sponsored the writing of this book, to look at different ways and different models that will support this multi-generational view going into the future. So Coast Funds is a model of what's called Project Finance for Permanence, which is the creation of permanent long-term funding contributed by governments, contributed by groups like the Moore Foundation and the Nature Conservancy to support Indigenous-led conservation and sustainable economic activity together over this very, very long term. So we're now seeing in the last 2 years the Great Bear Sea Project Finance for Permanence, enabling that sort of care being applied to the ocean and ocean resources, the Great Bear Rainforest Agreements, taking care of the Great Bear Rainforest, and not just by protecting areas from any harvesting, but by providing alternative support or funding for Indigenous communities to look for more sustainable ways to prosper economically using these old practices that allow that multi-generational approach. And so it's pretty exciting times to see this kind of thing happening around the world too. We're seeing these projects like this in Africa, in South America, you know, across the world, in Asia. Mm-hmm. Mongolia is looking at this kind of activity now. And you know, it gives me a huge amount of hope for the future when we see that kind of uptake on these ideas going forward, that, you know, 100 years from now, people will read this place as who we are and see it as very historical, because that's not the way things are anymore.
We are speaking with author Catherine Palmer Gordon about her new book titled This Place Is Who We Are: Stories of Indigenous Leadership, Resilience, and Connection to Homelands. And there's a descriptor of the book that talks about the fundamental concept of when the land is well, so are the people. And right there in the title, This Place Is Who We Are. Can you talk about why that title was so important and what that means?
When I sat down to write the book in the first place, that was my working title. I thought, I'll come up with something better eventually. But, you know, obviously that ended up being the title. And of course it was, because when these Indigenous people talk about their connection to place, it is fundamentally connected to their well-being, that human well-being and the place are one and the same things. And if you take care of the environment in which you're located, it will take care of you. And I mentioned earlier that all these protocols and laws about how to manage land and water and the relationship between humans and the land and water have developed over time. And again, Spencer and others in the book talk about this, that those laws and protocols were developed out of what the land and waters told the people. And they differ from place to place. Of course they do. If you're living in a river delta, the way in which you manage that will look a little bit different to if you're living in a fjord or on the west coast of Vancouver Island, which is very rugged and wild, as opposed to the very sheltered east coast of the island. But the protocols, or the principles of those protocols, tend to be very similar. And it's about the place telling you how to manage it rather than you trying to tell the place how you will manage it, which makes so much sense when you think about it and apply it in a modern context. For example, if you were going to want to do forestry on a mountain slope as opposed to in a river valley, you're going to use different techniques. You're going to need to think about the impact of taking trees upslope of a salmon-bearing creek. You're going to need to think about canopy cover and what's required to keep medicinal plants healthy underneath them, and where to leave alone, because we know that that is winter bear den habitat and we need to make sure that we leave that available. So all of these things are developed out of an understanding of place. And that defines the people. And you can see it often in the name of the people is the name of the place. Wow. They're one and the same thing. And if we looked at that more globally, looked at it in our own places that we're trying to manage and improve the management of, we can look back at the knowledge and experience that goes back to that place and think about how does that define us in this place? Because it's true of all humanity, that the places, even in these days where here's a New Zealand, a New Zealand accent living in on the other side of the world, and yet this place is where I've settled in. This place defines me now as I look out my window and see that there are pileated woodpeckers pecking away on the trees back there. Mm-hmm. I know I need to leave that tree there. I know there's an eagle nest on another tree just a little bit further back. This place is who I am now, and that defines how I manage it, even in my own little tiny corner of the universe.
In these last couple minutes, I'm curious about the process of writing this book and amplifying others' voices. What did that process look like? How did you create this book and want to be maybe more of a vessel to uplift different voices?
Thank you so much for asking that question. I really appreciate that, because it when I'm writing with Indigenous peoples, not about, but with, my process is 100% permission-based. That is, I respect that these are their stories. I mean, that's true of non-Indigenous people too. If I'm working with somebody to tell their story, it's their story, not my story. And so I go through a process to ensure that that they're comfortable with me even doing this. You know, I go through a process where they get transcripts of all the interviews and tell me if there's anything they don't want me to use. I send them the story plan. I send them the drafts. Mm-hmm. I send them the photos I want to use. Everything is 100% permission-based, so that when the book finally comes out, and this is true of my previous books as well, that everybody is proud of it and happy with it and celebrates it. And I'm completely transparent that I am non-Indigenous. I don't understand why anybody would pretend to be who they're not. Mm. But I'm here as an ally to support and amplify these voices. It's a lot of work. It takes way longer than it would if you didn't, but it's much more rich and it's much more respectful, and it reflects that reciprocity between human beings that's part of the Indigenous worldview.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I'm thinking that over hundreds of generations, story was really important. I know we only got like 30 seconds left, Catherine, but stories, there was no manuals written back then, like this is how to honor the pileated woodpecker if you see it feeding. It was communications, it was the voice, mm-hmm. it was stories that were handed down from generation after generation.
Yes, it was, and I love storytelling, and I'm so grateful and privileged to be able to do so.
So if people want to learn more about you, your other writings, and this book in particular, what can they do? Do you have a website, or where can they go?
You can find me on the website of the Writers Union of Canada under my name, Catherine Palmer Gordon. Look up Harbour Publishing, who I'm so grateful to for publishing this book and my other work. Those are probably the two best places to look if you're interested in Coast Funds and the work that they're doing as an Indigenous-led conservation organization, coastfunds.ca.
Well, fantastic. We so appreciate you and you bringing forward the stories of these voices that are so important for all of us to listen to and to have a greater understanding of our place on this earth and who we can learn from and how we can be better stewards moving forward for generations to come. This is Catherine Palmer Gordon. Her new book is called This Place Is Who We Are, Stories of Indigenous Leadership, Resilience, and Connection to Homelands. Thank you so much for being a part of This Green Earth, Catherine.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Yep.